the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak. This morning, Mary Beth Maziarz and I speak with Olympic legend Bodie Miller. He joins us for this month's Resilient Youth episode, underwritten by Live Like Sam. Bodie Miller will talk about grit, growth, and the power of failure. Hear his take on what it really means to build mental fitness and to live with purpose. Then in the second half, Dr. Brennan Spiegel, he's a professor of medicine, and he explains how gravity shapes far more than our posture, revealing how it influences our organs, cells, and overall health through the emerging science of biogravitational medicine. That all coming up this hour on The Mountain Life. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
This morning, for this month's Resilient Youth episode, we're joined by Olympic champion, father, and Park City resident Bodie Miller. It's a name synonymous with determination, grit, and heart. Bodie opens up about the true meaning of resilience, not just physical toughness, but the mental and emotional strength it takes to bounce back from setbacks and to find success on your own terms.
From embracing failure as life's greatest teacher to finding purpose in something bigger than yourself, Bodie shares how mental fitness, self-awareness, and hard work build the foundation for lasting growth and greatness. Bodie Miller, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you're pretty familiar with The Mountain Life, having worked on the mountain for much of your adult existence. What were some of the earliest things that you recall, experiences that started testing your own resilience?
I mean, I was really fortunate to grow up the way that I did. I think for my particular personality, we grew up off the grid in New Hampshire. And so we were a mile from the nearest road. So we walked to our house, and, you know, New Hampshire winters are relatively harsh. Through the snow, pulling groceries and siblings in sleds, and it's uphill. It's on the side of Kinsman Mountain, which is the range that Cannon Mountain is on, and Lafayette, and the Presidentials. So, you know, it was a pretty unique opportunity for me to kind of develop a lot of, I think, the attributes that we're referencing today, right? Like, I learned to walk up and down that hill on my own in dark. I mean, it gets dark at about 4:30 in New Hampshire in the winter. And that was often when I'd get back from skiing. I was homeschooled. So, you know, my mom would be a really funny person to have on here as well, because she was a really amazing, you know, unique character is. But back then she even was kind of, she said, more conscious of what she was doing in terms of how she would let me go outside. I'd go outside in the winter. You know, when I was 2 years old, I'd go out naked. And, you know, because I was used to it, I would have real good tolerance for the cold. I walk out there and start playing, and she'd kind of look out the window and be like, oh man, like, you know, in the normal for me, I'd be like, what are you doing? Get on coat and jacket and all this stuff. And I really have to work hard to try to channel some of her ability there and just be like, look, they'll figure it out or they won't. And she said I'd come back in after 5 or 10 minutes of walking around the snow with my bare feet, and I'd put on boots and go back out, and she'd be like, oh man, and it's still naked, but just boots on. And then I'd come back in 5 minutes later and put on a hat and then go back out. And then eventually, after an hour or two, she'd be like, you know, I'd ask her to help me put on pants or something like that. And I think that's the sort of a little bit of a microcosm of how I was raised, was like, it allowed me the maximum ability to understand my environment and understand accountability and self-reliance and risk management and, you know, I guess just awareness in general. And, you know, that seems like maybe the most challenging thing in our time now as parents is that we have self-awareness and we have all these things that we've developed over 20, 30, 40, 50 years, 80 years of life. But we forget that's developed. It's not just inherently there. And we try to push it on everybody else. And that just robs them of the opportunity to own it themselves and to develop it, you know, in an intrinsic way. When something's put on you, you can understand it, but it's different than if it comes truly from inside. And I think that's a challenge. And I think, you know, you need environment to stimulate that kind of growth. And you also need the sort of patience or the foresight of parents or caregivers to give you the opportunity to experience the environment that therefore fills out that gap. And that was, I was really fortunate with that, as I said, and I, you know, I really kind of thrived in that environment.
Yeah. And I that you bring up an interesting point. I think a lot about the helicopter parenting of the last, you know, 20 years. It's been so popular. And really, in some ways, it feels to me like that's depriving kids of the opportunity to really understand and test and explore their environments to the fullest. And it sounds like your experience really is a good example of that. Like, you were able to develop resilience on your own, not because someone taught it to you, but experientially, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's, I mean, if you read Thoreau or any of these, you know, kind of classic narrations of what that is, what is self-reliance, what is self-awareness, what's grit and determination and, you know, perseverance, they're all kind of internal mechanisms. They really don't have a lot to do with other people or external stuff. And I think that's kind of where I've focused in the last, you know, 15 years is trying to figure out environmental situations that allow that. I don't know if you guys watched the Special Forces thing that I did. I was on this television show called Special Forces, The World's Toughest Test. And it was pretty funny because they'd asked me to do it. I couldn't do it the year before. And then they asked again. And I was like, yeah, I'll do it. I mean, it's absolutely miserable. They take you down. They kind of, you know, we were in New Zealand and they have a bunch of kind of celebrities, varying degrees of, I would call it tough, but a lot of really fit people and then some not fit people. And the idea is just basically exactly like we're saying, but testing an adult version, right? Like, how tough are you? And how willing are you to push and being fully filmed the whole time? So you're very exposed, right? Like, you know, you're going to cry and you're going to maybe pass out or you're going to throw up. And like, these are guys who are special forces, you know, veterans, and they run the whole thing. And they do have to do a very tuned down version because it would just crack even me. But the point is, they don't care what you do, like how much you accomplish, say. They just care about versus your potential, what they view your potential. And they're incredibly insightful. I mean, absolutely as impressive as any group I've ever seen in terms of being able to judge somebody accurately and say, you're capable of this. You don't want to do it because you're lacking certain ability to push yourself. And that's it. And I think it was really cool to see. Most of the reason I did that was because I wanted to figure out, you know, that's a very developed system. That's how they do, you know, that's Hell Week. It's all the boot camps for these elite level military guys. And when your life's on the line, you want to know who you're standing next to. And they have a very well-developed system of how to test guys. And it, like I said, it's not about who's stronger. It's about that sort of core element of who the person is that really gives that, you know, the trust and camaraderie of those really tight elite fighting groups. So I was really trying to dig into that and see, you know, be able to try to cheat code off them if, like, you know, they have a very developed system and I want to be able to sort of, you know, use that for my kids, but also groups and people that I influence to try to help people to develop the stuff, because I don't think it's ever too late, but it certainly is optimal if you can do it when the kids are really young and they kind of own it themselves. Because even for all of us, you know, we're kind of playing catch up at this age.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with Olympic legend, World Cup champion, Bodie Miller. He's also a Park City resident, for now anyway. He's talking to us about resilience and youth resilience in our ongoing series. Bodie, first of all, I'm going to have that image of you as a two-year-old walking around naked in the snow for a long time.
But I didn't answer that.
No, that is so great. I mean, it's a little bit that notion of the free-range kids where you're learning your own limits. You're not having the limits put there so that you will always be protected and always be safe. I feel like maybe as we were all growing up, it was much more like that. I think the ability to know where our kids are all the time and be contactable all the time is something that maybe has eliminated that. And it kind of ties into that helicopter parenting notion or this era that we're in. But as you see how your mom especially parented you, and then how you're parenting your kids, and then how you propose to take that same bit forward and into the ski academy that you're working on, you know, how do you see it all fitting together? What changes would you make? What's your view on it all?
Yeah, I mean, it's really challenging, right? I mean, parenting is by far the most difficult thing that I've ever taken on. And as I said, I got to be the best in the world at a very difficult sport. So I think that that should put it into some perspective that I'm not just being, you know, hyperbolic on that. It truly is. It's just there's no letting up and there's no winning and there's no, it's simply a test that continues forever. And I think, you know, that's something that's worth every human on the planet to address, because it's also indicative of the challenge of life in general. This is just a piece of it, right? Like, you see it a different perspective when you start parenting, because you're trying to do the right thing. And you're always, if you're accurate, which I think was one of the things that I developed as a racer, if you're accurate with your self-assessment, you're not really doing that great. I mean, I love my kids and I try as hard as I can, but I just can see over and over and over again. And I don't try to sugarcoat it, because I do have that resilience, and I'm okay with being self-critical in the most positive way I can. I like to break it into three kind of components of, like, yourself, or the victim part of yourself, the coach part of yourself, and then sort of your higher self. And the, you know, when you get sad or you get in a bad spot, it's usually you're being the coach, but you're also being the victim, and you're being ineffective at how you're communicating back and forth. Like, you suck, or you're bad, or you failed, or whatever. And you're both, but then you kind of have to extract yourself up to the higher bit and be like, yo, coach, I think there's a better way to do this. And then you got to be yourself and be like, you know, this takes patience, forgiveness. I'm just a little baby who got a lot bigger and took on a lot more responsibility. And then I think that the whole thing starts to be a lot more productive, because the coach part of you is always there. People would call it the ego or whatever else, but you have to be, I think, effective at seeing the big picture and trying to move things forward. And, you know, with my kids, no, we have screens and we have, you know, and they all want us to do everything for them, and they expect you to, like, you know, triple check all their stuff when they go to a sports game, and then buy you new stuff if they forgot their stuff. And it's like, you know, there's so many lessons that were drilled into me through reality that I wish I was more disciplined or more focused or more capable of imparting on my kids. But I just continually come up short in those, and that's part of my challenge. And I'm constantly trying to figure out how to do a better job with it. But I do think that a big part of where we're going to move to, both as a family, but as a community here in Park City, and hopefully as a country, and ultimately as a species on the planet, is really trying to reestablish some of the youth-led stuff. That's where I feel like we're completely failing right now, is we assume that we have to dictate down, right? Like, coaches, teachers, parents have to dictate down. And I think a big part of the next step is going to be allowing for, or at least setting up the infrastructure to allow youth-led stuff. It's what lets more bullyish kind of alpha boys soften and be more forgiving and better with other kids, is when they get to lead in a really productive way and also get to feel the humility that it takes to operate as a team, as a group, and a family, not just their own alpha, you know, win everything kind of mentality. And I think it's ultimately what allows people to, you know, to develop those skills that I said I got sort of luckily through my upbringing. But if you just kind of let them operate within a loose structure, I think they can figure out so much more than we could ever try to dictate down to them.
Well, this would be a good time to segue into the ski academy that you're developing in Granby, Colorado, and how that youth-led structure might look in an example like that.
Yeah, I'm hopeful that we can get that done. I think it's, you know, our education system in general, but especially surrounding the sports, it's kind of been stagnant for loosely 50 years or 70 years, who knows? And I think we can all agree that times have changed significantly. I mean, there's whole components of textbooks that are irrelevant, that have been factually proven wrong, and, you know, history and everything else. So I think there's absolutely a need to sort of revamp or update our system. But within that, I figure, why not try to do it right? You know, try to build something right from the beginning that really allows to develop well-rounded, you know, solid human beings, you know, that have the ability and the capacity and the desire to learn. You know, that's kind of the purpose of youth programs, I think, is to develop those things that you don't need to drill in information, because ultimately the learning process should go on for forever. So within the academy, yeah, there's a huge component of it that's youth driven. So in terms of everyday tasks, like the economic structure of the academy becomes much more efficient because the kids have to do a lot more work, which I think most parents will agree that's good. They have to do a lot of the cleaning. They have to do a lot of the dishes. They have to do a lot of the food prep. Those are skills that are important for the rest of their life. And it becomes normalized remarkably quickly. It's just shocking how hard it is to do in your own house. I can attest from myself. And then taking a lot of pride in the work you do, right? Those are two component parts. You have to provide the opportunity for them to do the work. And then you have to create the environment where they can take pride in the quality of work or the effort that they put into achieving a task that kind of sucks, right? Like you want to, it can't be something that's super fun, because that's much easier to enjoy the work effort sort of, you know, correlation into that. But it has to be something that's pretty lousy, pretty crappy, and they still have to figure that out. And, you know, those are kind of backbone components that I think are really lacking these days in most of our structures, most of our systems around. And, you know, there's a great sort of tie-in to sports, because sports, you get a lot of the same things, but typically they're things that the kid wants to do, right? Like, I want to get good at my sports, so I'm willing to work really hard and put in a lot of effort. And parents take a lot of pride in that, myself included, that you know, kids really try hard and they try to improve. And then you just have to kind of separate that from, like, okay, that's fine, but does that really work when it's something crappy, right? When it's something that has to be done, when it's something that they're going to have to deal with for the rest of their lives. And I think most parents would attest that you'll see that system crumble pretty quick in that scenario. And they start half-assing and kind of whining. And, like, you know, those are sort of the foundational goals of the academy, aside from elite level education and an opportunity to develop elite level sports. But a lot of it is kind of modernizing that.
We just got back. We were in Boston area over the past few days, and we went up to Marblehead to visit some friends, and their daughters are both in a sailing academy that's completely run by kids. And I'd never even really known that this was a thing. Like, and the kids, the daughters were 9 years old, and they took so much ownership of it. They felt really proud of it, and they were talking about it, and they were so excited about it, and then the roles that they would get to take the following summer. And it was a revelation that you could. I thought it's going to be like Lord of the Flies. It's all going to break down. It's going to be terrible. But in fact, life is like Lord of the Flies. It's going to break down anyway. So you might as well learn earlier about the things. But I love what you're saying about the different kind of the scut work that is a part of everything. And I think that's another thing that our kids are being protected from a lot. Everybody does all the background parts, and then they get to come and do the big show. And so I think that's wonderful. What, as a parent yourself, you have a large family, what kind of challenges to resilience are you seeing with your kids right now? Maybe there's a range, because I know their age range is wide. And how are you finding yourself challenged by their challenges?
My 12-year-old is very much in this kind of independence, wants his own, wants to be able to make his own decisions and wants to have a lot of freedom. And unfortunately, and I would be much more inclined to let him do that had he been raised the way that I was raised, you know. And but because he's kind of halfway or less than halfway in terms of where he's come from, it's just really hard to do. And I think, you know, that's the trap that all the parents in our country specifically probably fall into, is that, like, you feel like you're already too far down a specific road and it's too hard to change. And so my wife and I constantly talk about, you know, how do we shift that? How do we move it more into, you know, developing little humans who have some, you know, ability to think things through, or ability to take accountability when they make mistakes or stuff like that. So, I mean, how we deal with it? Not well. I mean, we try, but that's what I mean. It's, you know, what we're trying to do now is force them to do, you know, some harder tasks, but allow them to understand the concept of doing those without a reward, in a sense. Like, try to figure out the right way to impart that sort of non-reward-based hard work ethic. and feel good about it. And that's a challenge because they're good little communicators and they say, I don't feel good about it. I'm like, yeah, well, that's what I'm trying to fix right now, is that there is something that's possible to develop the ability to take pride in doing something well, even if the thing sucks. Is it enjoyable? No, the thing is not enjoyable, but it's something special to understand that it's okay and it's appropriate and good to take pride in something. And doing something nice for somebody else is really great. And it does ultimately fill you up. Does that always feel good at that moment? No. And it can sometimes feel annoying or a burden, or like people are taking a little piece of you. I've said that for years to my kids. It's like, I do all these things for charities and foundations, and does it always feel good? No, it doesn't. It can be hard. It's a demand on my time and it's effort. And sometimes the situations are annoying or, you know, but ultimately I take pride in the fact that I'm trying to make a positive impact and trying to lend myself to doing something good. And that's offsetting. And it's not a thing that you have to always measure. You don't always have to measure it. You just have to sometimes get it done. And so I try to share a lot of sort of my experiences with them to try to help that and really give them some detail behind it of examples of when I'm doing that and also how it makes you feel or why I do it that way. And then we try to break that down into like more component parts about their daily things, right? Like how we make their breakfast and how we do their lunches and how we drive them around to places without it being a guilt thing. Cause it's not like, we don't want them to feel like, you know, that we're guilt tripping them. Like, we do all these things for you and you don't appreciate it, which is obviously true, but we try to do it in a way that's more like, this is why I do it. I do it because I think it's the right thing and I love you and I want to support you. And that's it. And kind of like try to bridge that gap. But I think, you know, there's obviously, we're inundated with so much kind of science of like, oh, the brain isn't developed yet. They don't even understand these things. I'm not sure I buy into that stuff. I think there's component parts just from, you know, understanding our basic developmental, you know, patterns. I've seen other cultures and other places where it just doesn't appear to be the case. I think we're making excuses for our style in that regard. I think there's places that I've been all around the world and even just different families where the kids are so much more capable of every component of like what you'd consider adult cognition or processing or everything else. And they're
even just skill sets. Like you see in some places that the kids are helping prep dinner with very sharp knives,
yeah.
Or they're, you know, they're cooking on the stove. They're doing things around the household that maybe it's our litigious society or something, but that we've become so safety aware that, again, I feel like we're stripping opportunity for kids to learn with a small nick on your finger that this is a very sharp knife before, you know, they get to a point where they've never used a knife and they're 13 years old or 15 years old and they're wondering why it's so hard. It's just a tricky thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And understanding, like I said, even just hard work, right? Like we live on the side of the hill at Jeremy Ranch and I have them go up and move rocks. And I'm like, you know, I need you to move these rocks. And they're like, they're too heavy. And I'm like, no, they're not. Like, figure it out. Figure out how to move all these rocks over there. And like, why are we doing this? And I'm like, because I asked you to, and I need you to dip it. And they know that there's no reason for moving the rocks, but you know, they're the point that when you get them, especially for boys, like, you know, I got five boys kind of stacked in the middle and there's the right dynamic that you can create there, you know, where they do start to get it and you get little glimpses of it that are, you know, it's rewarding in its own way, just because, as I said, I'm more or less just flailing around in the dark, trying to figure out solutions to things that I wish there was a manual. I wish there was somebody who was, you know, ultimately much more wise and could sort of help me, but that's just not the nature of it. And that's the point, is that's not the nature of it for them either. So we're all in the same boat there. It's kind of like just trying to figure out. And I think there's a huge part of that, like I said, had to be, but like, I do spend a lot of time asking them questions and trying to, you know, communicate with them because, you know, you do lose a lot of perspective as you get older, right? I'm almost 50 and it feels like I would remember or think of how it was to be a little kid. It's not the case. So there's a huge gap between them and me in terms of even what I can feel or remember how it all was, you know, and where the challenges really were.
Yeah. Before we let you go, Bodhi, I just wanted to recap, you know, that concept that you came up with of having pride at doing things that aren't necessary, you know, like the dirty jobs. You can do the dirty jobs and feel pride in things that maybe don't seem so glorious, like, you know, winning an Olympic medal. And you can feel pride with that. Kind of similarly, I'm wondering, you know, I've heard people talk about, you know, oh, we need to teach our kids. First of all, it was everyone's a winner, right? Everyone gets a trophy. But now we're saying, oh, but wait, we've got to embrace failure. And it's like, if you haven't given them a structure to embrace failure, failure's still really hard. And failure is a funny word to even use, but, you know, maybe not getting to where you wanted to get or not having your, you know, your greatest desire realized.
Less than optimal.
Yeah, less than optimal. How do you teach that structure of accepting and even embracing the less than optimal outcome?
Yeah, and I try to give them examples, right? And like the reality is that I'm trying to paint for them is that it's all around us all day. Like failure is when you quit, when you stop. That's when you could measure a failure. And that's usually something that has a terminal element, right? Something that ultimately ends and you can equate, like, was this a success or was this a failure? And it's finished. That's when you can do that, like a test, right? Like, did I fail on a test? Yes, you can fail on a test because it has an end point. All the other stuff is just the process, right? Like, less than optimal things happen every single day. When you tried to learn to walk, it was less than optimal in the beginning. And then ultimately you learn to walk and it's still less than optimal. You're not perfectly in balance. You're not light on your toes and you're not springing around. Like, and that happens all the way through our lives. None of us are ultimately optimal walkers and we've been doing it our whole lives. It's just the way it works, right? We all have little things, little imbalances or little hitches. It's just how it is. And so I try to tell them, like, that's part of every day. So you just have to equate, instead of specific acute, you know, failure points or pressure points that everyone puts focus on, just view it as the whole thing, right? The whole thing is a big process. And there are going to be times where you're going to feel the sting of a failure more, you know, where it has an impact. It is a true failure. Like I said, a test, an element, a soccer game that you really wanted to win that you didn't win. Those are things that you can sort of say, you know, but then even within that, you see a bigger picture. Okay, but I did a lot of really good things. The outcome wasn't what I wanted. You can view it as, okay, and without making excuses is a huge part of it too that I try to tell them. It's like excuses deflect the ability to really gain the most from a less than optimal situation. Excuses defer. You want to accept as much as you possibly can to ultimately get the most out of it. You know what I mean? Like that, and that's a huge part of sports for my kids is like when you fail, you could say it was your goalie's fault or it was everybody else's fault and I did awesome, but everyone else stunk. And like, okay, that might be true. But within that context, there's other things that you obviously could have done differently or better that would have allowed you to have a different outcome. Maybe, maybe not. But either way, you still have to judge yourself effectively and accurately and take the most accountability for the situation to get the most growth out of it. And that's kind of, you know, we talk growth mindset and a lot of other things, but it's really trying to break those sort of patterns of thinking that you're doing great through because a day you don't get in trouble or just a day in general. And instead of looking at the day in general, I do it every morning by 8:30. I get the kids off to the school bus and I had my little moment where I'm like, come on, Miller, you can do better than that. Like, yeah, or it's like, yes, that was a really good morning. I'll give myself 8 out of 10 on this morning. You know, and I think that's an important thing for adults as well as kids. And I think so much of this conversation and the challenges around it are about tone and intention and how you speak to kids. Like my grandfather had this saying at our tennis camp that ultimately I think was the backbone of what made our camp so incredible for all these. And he'd give this speech before every session started about givers and takers. And he would say the world can be broken into two parts. And, you know, yes, a person can be in both at different times. But the point is there's two groups. There's givers and there's takers. The takers are the ones who will drop their trash on the side of the road or do whatever, or will, you know, they just take, right? There's that component. And the way he spoke it resonated with kids who were 10 years old all the way up to the counselors and everybody else. And it was that tone and the intention behind it was so genuine. And the givers are the people who are willing to give without getting something back, It's the intent of knowing that you're not going to get something back and doing the right thing when no one's looking. You know, on the side of the road, you pick up the trash and put it in the trash, or you do a task that needs to be done because you know it needs to be done, regardless of whether somebody else should have done it, or you let go of all that and you simply do the right thing. I think that is, you know, again, it's a challenge for all of us adults to not dictate and not try to like drive something in, but to offer an opportunity. You know, it's more like, here is the most pure version I can give you. Take it for what you want. And I think that's a very challenging message to have that tone with, because it tends to be very lecturing and kids automatically hear the Charlie Brown whenever you're in that tone. And you have to kind of do it in a different way to make them understand it. But that message is so powerful that I try to work on my kids all the time. So far, very limited success, but I'll keep you guys updated.
Please do. Bodie Miller, he's an Olympic legend, a father. I probably should have said father first, because that's taking center stage. Okay, a husband, father, Olympic champion, Bodie Miller. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Mountain Life. It's been great. And what I love to hear is that you don't think you're doing it perfectly. So it gives the rest of us a lot of hope. Thank you.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
Gravity. It's invisible, it's constant, and so familiar that we hardly notice it. But what if gravity isn't just a background force, but a key player in our health? From anxiety and gut disorders to Alzheimer's, our next guest, UCLA professor and Cedars-Sinai gastroenterologist, Dr. Brennan Spiegel, believes gravity may be the missing link.
In his new book, Pull, How Gravity Shapes Your Body, Steadies the Mind, and Guides Our Health, Dr. Spiegel introduces the emerging field of biogravitational medicine. He reveals how love feels like falling, why our gut helps keep us upright, and how evidence-based practices can build resilience against the Earth's constant pull.
Dr. Spiegel, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we have not had a conversation about the effects of gravity on our health. I think it's a bit revolutionary. What would you say about that?
You know, it's interesting because I guess it's revolutionary in that there hasn't been a lot of discussion about it, but at the same time, it's almost obvious. Gravity was here long before the first signs of life. It will be here long after we're gone. So it stands to reason that every part of our bodies, every cell, every organ, every tendon, even the nervous system and our brains evolved to manage this fundamental force that we all experience. And depending on how well you stand up and stay up in its grip will determine your health span.
We all know that gravity contributes to our posture or poor posture. But even that is something that I haven't thought about. I just think about my posture. I don't think about it in relation to gravity. So let's start there with just a simple explanation of gravity against our spine.
Right. So most of our evolutionary history was spent as four-legged creatures. It's only in the last bit of our evolution that we stood up and our center of gravity became much smaller and higher, and that put a lot of pressure on our bodies, particularly the lower back. What is low back pain, if not a form of gravity intolerance? What is swelling around the ankles, if not gravity intolerance? A dizziness, vertigo, where the inner ear is losing track of your relationship to the Earth's literal pull upon your body, which in turn can lead to anxiety and panic attacks and out-of-body experiences that can be traced back to the inner ear losing track of gravity. And so you asked about the spine and the back and posture. And so I'm a gastroenterologist, and I spent a lot of time thinking about the gut. And I noticed a lot of my patients have back pain in addition to stomach pain. And what I realized is, you know, we all have a sack of potatoes, right, in our belly that we have to hang and hoist our entire lives. And some people are better at porting around that sack of potatoes than others. And it turns out there are suspension systems in the body that pull up that sack of potatoes, and they all connect right into the middle back. So if you have a weak back, and you don't have strong core muscles and back muscles, you literally let your belly hang down and it compresses the belly, which leads to stomach issues, gas, bacterial overgrowth. And so standing up, being strong, having your shoulder blades, you know, taut behind you, shoulders back, diaphragm up, that pulls up that sack of potatoes. Like a marionette on strings, you want to pull up the marionette so you can animate it. Whereas if there's stretchy strings or you let your hands down, the marionette will collapse. So those are just some thoughts about the back and the belly and what we can do about it.
Of all the things that I've ever heard about how important it is to keep our core strong, I never thought about that in that exact way, that I want my abs to support that sack of potatoes, yeah. Which very often my abs feel like in there. That is incredible. That's a great analogy. And I remember being pregnant, my psoas muscles just killed. And those are the ones that stretch around from like beneath the belly to the back. And I was never aware of them until you had that. And so that's...
Well, that's such an interesting example. You know, we refer to a gravid uterus, which is a uterus that has a developing child in it. And that comes from gravity. Gravid, it's a heavy, you know, weight. And you bear that weight. And there are examples of elite athletes who actually perform even better after they have given birth because they have been hoisting a weight and working out their body and back throughout the entirety of their pregnancy and come out even stronger as a result of having, you know, borne that weight. Literally, gravity strengthened their body when the weight is gone.
Wow, those are very special people because I don't know that I felt stronger right away after having a baby, but I definitely know that it made me stronger in lots of other ways. I am curious about the spine a little bit more. I've heard the term that like yogis will say that you're only as old as your spine. Mm. And it also makes me think about maybe astronauts. When they go into space, we hear about how their spines decompress a little bit. Is that correct? Can we talk just a little bit about like the different ways that our spine reacts to gravity?
Yeah. And it's not even just the spine, it's all the bones. Oh. So when we bear weight, the bones feel the pressure, whether it's along the spine, which is sort of the chassis that holds up that sac and all the stuff we've been talking about in the belly, or even your legs, the femur, the long bones feel that pressure. And there's something called the gravidostat, which is like a thermostat in your body for weight management. And if you wear a weighted vest, for example, which I regularly do at work, and I have a standing desk, you put weight on your body, the bones feel it. And there's evidence that they almost interpret that as gravity being too strong and we need to get lighter. So the gravidostat is a system that will increase metabolic activity and lead to weight loss as a result of bearing extra weight. So the spine is really important to not only signal to the brain how much weight you're bearing at any moment, but the reverse is true too. Astronauts, you mentioned, who have no weight upon their body do expand in length, but their bones don't feel that pressure. The gravidostat ends up down-regulating, and the bones actually become thin and brittle, and astronauts are at risk for osteoporosis because they're not bearing the weight. We evolved with and for gravity like a fish in water. The fish is designed to survive and thrive in water, and that's like us to gravity. And if we remove the gravity, our body also starts to break down in interesting and important ways.
Dr. Spiegel, this is almost sounding contradictory in a way. And I'm going to say that every time I go to the doctor and they say, you know, you really should be doing these weight-bearing exercises to keep from getting osteoporosis, osteopenia. And you say, yeah, okay, but I gave up running, for example, although I do still run somewhat, but I kind of gave it up because it was hurting my hips and my knees, and it felt like it was pounding. And we know that the fact that you stand at your stand-up desk with a weighted vest seems contradictory because we know that carrying extra weight isn't good for us. So if it's weight that's just in our bodies as fat, I suppose. Can you unravel that?
Yeah, so it's a use it or lose it with our bodies. And of course, we don't want to bear too much weight. So it's always about starting low and going slow and working with what you can bear. It's always good to talk to a doctor or a physical therapist to make sure you're not overloading your system. But the weighted vest I use has little pockets for the weights. And I could increase or decrease the amount of weight very precisely. Now, I happen to wear a 20-pound weighted vest, and I wear 20-pound ankle weights on each ankle. So I bear 60 extra pounds, and I stand on a balance board at work. So I'm constantly engaging my body with gravity, just like all of human history. Where I'm standing right now in the middle of Los Angeles, if I went back 200 years ago, not 2,000 years ago, just a couple generations ago, there would be chaparral out there. There would be no buildings, very few, maybe some farmers working the land. And that was 200 years ago. They were working hard, strong, engaging with the planet's pull all the time. And now we don't. We're sedentary and we're suffering as a result of not engaging with gravity. Gravity will pull you down if you don't stand up to it. And we're learning that lesson now in modern medicine, whether it's obesity or sedentary lifestyles, weak abs, weak core, weak legs, weak bones. You give in. You literally give in to gravity. It pulls you back down. And to be poignant for a second, in some traditions, we end up in a grave, which is a word derived from the word gravity. It's a gravity box. We literally want to stay out of that. You have to stand up. That's really what biogravitational medicine is all about, is how do you stay up and out mentally and physically?
I'm wondering if similarly when after a woman who has been pregnant and has had this extra 40, 50, 60, you know, however many pounds, is it the same for people who lose several hundred pounds or 100 pounds or 50 pounds? Have they experienced something that has actually been good for them?
Absolutely. In so far as losing the weight is a relative change. And if you can maintain muscle tone during the weight loss period, so preferentially lose adipose tissue and muscle tissue, you can maintain a strong muscular frame with less fat, especially the adipose tissue in the mesentery, which is the suspension system in your belly that holds up that sack of potatoes. That's what we call visceral fat. And that's the dangerous metabolically active form of fat that literally weighs you down on the inside and can give rise to diabetes and metabolic syndrome. And so if you can reduce that core weight while maintaining the strength that you already achieved to port it around, yeah, there's something to be said about, not that I would advise gaining weight for that purpose, obviously. You can wear a weighted vest or other ways to gain weight. But yeah, it's like all relative.
I know in some of your other work before this, you've found how effective virtual reality can be upon the body's perception of pain. And we got the kids one of the Oculus things a few years ago, and it was shocking how convincing it is to experience this. There is one where you step out on a plank, and it is literally terrifying. I wondered if is visualization that you do without a virtual reality, is that as an effective tool, or do we need those external sensory cues for our bodies to really buy it?
Well, what a great question. This kind of gets at an even bigger question. Are we even living in a simulation right now? There's some debate about that, because simulations are convincing. And we do use virtual reality to practice mental elevation, to literally float up into the sky, into the clouds for patients in the hospital who are vulnerable, who are literally depressed. And there's a discussion about gravity. We think for a second, what does it feel like to be depressed? It's almost like there's too much gravity on your body. You can't get out of bed. You're exhausted. You pull yourself up. You have no energy. You're looking down at your feet. Your shoulders are slumped over. It's like the earth is too big for your body. And it turns out that we do perceive gravity in the brain, as you can imagine. It's called graviception. And there's a part of the brain that is involved, called the insula, in processing all of these signals. And if your brain misinterprets the force of gravity as being too much, you can literally embody that in your body and in your mind. And I'm not saying all depression is from gravity intolerance. But there's a very powerful theory that in some cases it is. And virtual reality allows us to simulate in your mind's eye the process of elevation. And that happens in an area called the anterior insula of the brain, where you can, like a physics engine in your brain, process experiences that are not actually occurring, but they are illusory, but they actually affect the body. Your cortisol and stress hormone levels can go down, heart rate changes, white blood cell count changes in the body, if you can simulate in your mind's eye these experiences. And the idea of falling, like when you fall on a roller coaster, you get gut feelings. My patients with IBS don't often want to ride a roller coaster because they're feeling that all the time. It's like there's a G-force accelerometer in your gut telling you that you're at risk and you want to stay away from that. So once again, we use it for anxiety too, VR. So there's a lot of interesting overlaps here.
That phrase, the G-force accelerometer in our gut, is such an interesting way to think about it. How and or why has the gut seemed to have become this connection between our nervous system and the brain's, the logical perception of danger or concern?
Yeah. Well, Hippocrates famously said, I don't know who was there recording him, but he said, you know, all disease begins in the gut. He said that in somewhere in the 300 range BC, allegedly. Well, what does that mean? So in the book, in this book, Pull, I talk about the gut a lot and its role in gravity management. And so this all begins in the oceans where we think life began, around dark, hot, gassy worlds like hydrothermal vents. And in the ocean, things were buoyant, floating. But once these amphibious creatures started crawling out onto land, gravity hit them. And they needed to find new ways to stand up to this force. Well, it turns out we had our own hydrothermal vent in our body. And that's the colon and the gut itself, a hot, dark, gassy place where, guess who hitched a ride? All of those bacteria, all that microbiome, those trillions of organisms in our body came with us. And what did they give us? They gave us something quite amazing. They gave us serotonin. Most people think of serotonin as a mood elevator, a booster for mental health. And it is that. Literally, elevate is up and depress is down. Serotonin boosts you, but most all of it, 95% of it, is not in the brain. It's in the gut. It's the microbiome in your body churning out, if you eat the right foods, by the way, serotonin. And in the book, I talk about how serotonin, if you look at it, is actually a gravity management substance. Without it, you and I would be flaccid sacks on the ground right now, unable to move like a baby, who, by the way, has very little serotonin in their body because they haven't colonized their gut yet and have no serotonin to pump their tubes and move the hydraulics and develop their muscles. So, you know, the details we can spend an hour talking about, but the gut is so important because it sits right between the nervous system and the outside world and the food we eat. And the microbiome is vital for allowing us to stand up and stay up and thrive mentally and physically.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with Dr. Brendan Spiegel. He's the author of a new book called Pull, How Gravity Shapes Your Body, Steadies the Mind, and Guides Our Health. He is a gastroenterologist, but he is also introducing this field of biogravitational medicine. He is a pioneer in digital therapeutics and immersive medicine. We better ask you, you've already talked about gravity intolerance, and these are things like, when you mentioned plantar fasciitis, something that I struggled with for so long as a runner, and other sort of maladies of gravity intolerance. But you also talk about gravity resilience. And yes. So this would be like Mary Beth was talking about, really engaging your core when you're doing different activities, and that will protect different systems. But what else can we do to create gravity resilience?
Oh, yeah.
In our everyday lives.
The first thing is figuring out what is your gravitype. So in the book, I introduce 8 gravitypes. And there's a quiz you can take online. I put this quiz on my website. So you can just go to my name is BrennanSpiegelMD.com. And on that website, there's a 16-item questionnaire that you can take. And it's going to ask you questions about, do you get lightheaded if you stand up too quickly? You know, ask questions about your strength walking up and down stairs. Do you get short of breath? Can you stand on one leg for 10 seconds without getting wobbly? You know, do you feel literally weighted down mentally if things aren't going well? These kinds of questions. And it will then map you to one of 8 gravitypes. And depending upon which one you're in, the gravity master is sort of the perfect situation and the overwhelmed defender is the other side of it. There's all sorts of in-betweens. It will give you a list of things to think about, activities. It might be anything from inverted yoga positions to tilt table therapy to flotation therapy to vagus nerve stimulation, which is, I believe, a gravity management technique to boost serotonin in your body, diet, how to improve serotonin flow in your body through high tryptophan diet. The list kind of goes on. And in the book, there's a whole resource guide of specific activities that you can think about, but of course, always work with the doctor. I'm a doctor. This is meant to be adjunctive because everyone's different, unique. But a lot of these ideas are already evidence-based. It's not like there's some woo science here. This is stuff we already do. It's just very few doctors prescribe, let's say, flotation therapy for depression or vagus nerve stimulation, or have even heard of it.
We have definitely heard of it because we actually interviewed a doctor who wrote a book on vagus nerve stimulation, and it was fascinating. We consider ourselves on the forefront of all things happening in the world. To that end, and I know we do need to wrap up soon, but for the average person, should we be doing legs up the wall or the occasional headstand or table? It seems like it'd be good for circulation at the very least.
Absolutely. I mean, for sure. So if you think about just what happens when you're sleeping at night for a second, you know, there's reason to believe that part of sleep is to simply change your brain's relationship to gravity. All day long, you're upright and your cardiovascular system and pumps and tubes and hydraulics are pushing blood up into your brain, trying to keep it oxygenated so we can talk to each other and not pass out. That's why it's important to drink a lot of water, by the way. The less water you drink, the lower your blood pressure. And that alone is associated with Alzheimer's, as is high sodium levels associated with dementia, in part because you don't have enough fluids in your body perfusing your brain all day. When we lay down flat, the brain gets a completely different relationship to gravity. We perfuse the brain with oxygen, purge out amyloid. It's really important, and gravity management is part of it. So then you can imagine during the day, does it make sense to flip yourself upside down on occasion? Inverted yoga is a very easy, effective way to do that. Some people use tilt tables. And now if you have high blood pressure or glaucoma, obviously be a little careful. But for the most part, for most people, it's very safe and people really love it for strengthening their backs, lengthening themselves and reperfusing the upper part of their body in a way that they don't normally get through everyday living.
Dr. Brennan Spiegel and his new book is called Pull. Thanks for listening to The Mountain Life here on KPCW. If you like what you hear, leave us a comment, rate us, and be sure to subscribe to stay on top of all of our show episodes. And if you have an idea for a future episode of The Mountain Life, email us at themountainlife@kpcw.org.